Welcome, everybody, as we continue. We started, of course, a new season or a new session, the autumn, but our fall session. But this, of course, is a continuation class. We haven't met for a few weeks because of Yontif. I hope everybody had a wonderful Yontif, meaningful Yontif, a joyous Yontif, and we look forward to learning. We have many upcoming classes, a new series starting tomorrow. There's our next one, Rachel Danziger. Sharansky will be beginning, or Sharansky Danziger will be beginning her series on Genesis, the beginning of human relationships. So that's tomorrow at 11 a.m. Thursday, Shuli Mishkin will be beginning her series on medieval Jewry, between the Crescent and the Cross, her tours of Israel. Then the next week, Rabbi Liebtag will be starting. We're starting a few more classes. Of course, watch your emails. And so it's a pleasure to have everybody. And like I always say, invite your friends to come, invite a friend to come. Okay. As we start today, I want to thank Stephanie Magonet and Morty Shapiro, who are sponsoring the class today in observance of the yahrzeit of Stephanie's father, Eliyahu Ben Levi Dov. I should have good memories. I know the yahrzeit was a few weeks ago, sort of during our time lull, but should have good memories and long life, and we should have many occasions to celebrate the happy occasions. And with that, Dr. Shapiro, with that longer introduction than usual, Vakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you. So I'll go 2 extra minutes. Glad to be back. A lot to do. But because I only like to spend 15 minutes, no more, I like to spend 45 minutes on the new stuff. I won't get to everything, and thanks to all of the people who wrote to me. Here's some of the stuff I have to get to. So I'll just start at the top, and I'll work my way 15 minutes through, and then we'll stop, and I'll continue for next week. By the way, I saw on the Jewish Link that in Teaneck, Yerushalayim of New Jersey, they're even having scholars in residence now. So I can tell you that I hope to soon have an announcement for Torah in Motion, an exciting announcement soon that Baruch Hashem, things are changing in terms of scholars in residence. If your shul's open, I'm open. So I'm waiting for those promised invitations to start flooding my mailbox. I not relevant to anything we're doing in the class, except for the fact that I did speak to Rabbi Temler once about Rav Shaul Lieberman and Rav Moshe, etc. But we do have to acknowledge that we lost another great individual with Rav Moshe Temler. I didn't know him that well. I was a speaker at his shul twice, and I had conversations with them. There's plenty of people here. You might even have people from his shul. Suffice to say, he was a one of a kind. And obviously, he's an expert in medical ethics. And in fact, his last article just appeared in the latest Hakira on halachic issues related to synthetic biology. He was very active until the end, and as I said, an expert in medical ethics. There's another, if you're not interested in that, there's another side to him. I'll just say he was a character. We all know that if you knew him. You know, the Torah says, Lo Saguru, rabbis are not supposed to be afraid. Other than Rabbi Tendler, I have never known a rabbi, and this includes Gedol Yisrael, who was not afraid. They all were afraid. They're afraid of being attacked by the crazies, by the extremists. Rabbi Tendler, Mamish, was not afraid, like nothing you've ever seen. And if any of you want to get a sense just of his personality, and I'll just call 3 things to your attention. I'm not going to play them for you in the interest of time, but let me show you 3 things here. Hold on a second. Here, let's pull this up for you. Just on your own, you can look. The first thing is, first watch you can watch some of the Levaya, in particular Reuven Feinstein. It's very interesting what Reuven Feinstein says and how he describes the person he describes as his big brother. Also, I'll get to what Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport says as well. But I highly encourage everyone to watch Rabbi Tendler on the Temple Mount. Actually, let me make sure I have a sound here if I want to play you something. It is interesting. His trips, he always goes up to the Temple Mount when he would go to Eretz Yisrael.
Rebbe, what significance do you give to that building? Does it mean anything to us? Is it at least a keeper on the holy spot? Is it something?
According to our tradition, and there's a machlokes, of course, all traditions have machlokes, because history lies But this seems to be true. This was the base Kachi Kadosha.
Okay, so you can, I highly encourage watching that. If you want to get a sense of the way he spoke, I'm not going to play this. I don't want to get in trouble. But during the brain death, he gave it, this is 10 years ago, so he's not a young man. You have to listen to what he says about the English chief rabbinate, what he says about Jonathan Sacks. I mean, he calls it like he sees it. And then you can listen to another video, what he says about the RCA. It just, he was a one of a kind. So let's leave it at that. He will certainly be greatly missed in the Orthodox world. Incidentally, since I mentioned the new Chakira, this is at the bottom of my pile, we're going to be talking a lot the next couple of classes on the Orthodox-conservative relationship, a relationship that had difficulties, but also could have close personal friendships. We'll talk about that. I've mentioned in the past, one of the things I mentioned was the relationship of Rabbi Soloveitchik to Rabbi Shubo. Rabbi Shubo, a big conservative rabbi in the Boston area, in the book published by Nadi Helfgott, I have it here. This book, I've mentioned it before, you have the letter that the Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote to Rabbi Shubo's synagogue explaining why he could not come to the event at the synagogue. They're launching this new Senate building, and he didn't want to give the impression that he supported Nick Seeding, but he wanted to honor Rabbi Shubo. In this new Chakira, what you have here is Rabbi Soloveitchik's Hesped, recently discovered. The family had it. The family is an Orthodox family in Israel. Rabbi Shubo's granddaughter is that Orthodox woman who runs marathons, if you can believe it. So Rabbi Shubo has famous Orthodox descendants. But when you read this eulogy of Rabbi Soloveitchik to Rabbi Shubo, Rabbi Soloveitchik was not a person who had many friends. People at that level don't have friends. It's very difficult because friends can only relate. Lieberman was a friend of his, but friends, you have to be like on the same level. Rabbi Shubo, as he explains, was one of his dearest and closest friends. You write about how Rabbi Soloveitchik describes, after his wife died and the body was still in the house, Rabbi Shubo comes over and the two of them recite Tehillim together. And it's an unbelievable description of Rabbi Shubo. And it's as we go into this discussion of conflict and controversy, it pays to remember the Rabbi Soloveitchik, who never wavered an inch on how to relate to the conservative movement, what he thought were halachic violations, in terms of friendship, the two had nothing to do with one another. I want to mention, going back to Rabbi Tenor for a second, because we spoke about this last semester, we spoke a good deal about Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport, we spoke about swordfish. Rabbi Tenor, one of his great contributions, if you think it's a contribution, is he's the reason we don't eat swordfish. This goes back to 1951, the OU published a list of kosher fish. And whereas the old Agudas Rabbanim list from the 40s permitted swordfish, and in Eretz Yisrael they permitted it, Rabbi Tendler said no. And that then became his claim to fame, or one of his claims to fame, that you can't get any swordfish anywhere. We spoke about even though Rav Heschel Schachter thinks is permissible, which it's hard to see how we can never go back to swordfish because we haven't done it for so long. However, if you listen to the Hespedim, you will hear Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport describes how he examined a swordfish and he saw that there were scales and he called Rav Tenler and Rabbi Tenler said, well, if there's scales, then you can eat it. So I'm thinking this is Rabbi Tenler changing his mind, his crusade of 60 years, or 50, 60 years. And but no, it wasn't, because you can go on YU Torah and you can see Rabbi Tenler. He actually must have retracted that again because he has a shear there. Affirming again, this is just from a few years ago, that swordfish is forbidden. He goes after Rav Schachter. I'm not going to repeat what he says about Rav Schachter. And after he's Rav Schachter's Rebbe. Rav Schachter is one of the people who gave the Hespeds. But, you know, in Rav Tenler's mind, if you speak falsehood, then especially as his Rebbe, he can call him out for it. But I want to show you something very interesting here. I contacted the swordfish expert, Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky. It was Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky who brought the swordfish. I should have realized who else around swordfish. And look at this 1 minute. This is, you will see, Rav Shabtai Cohen examining the swordfish. Now, we're going to talk later about the swordfish as well, I think, because this becomes an Orthodox conservative dispute. The swordfish becomes identified with Isaac Klein, who wrote the responsum permitting it, and conservative Judaism accepted it. And orthodoxy becomes identified in America, at least, with Rabbi Tenwer forbidding it. And you couldn't permit swordfish because that was the, in fact, that's Ari Zivotofsky's whole point. By definition, once it came into the Orthodox conservative dispute, you couldn't permit it. We'll see something very similar with prenuptial agreements. And the opposition to the Lieberman ketubah, as we'll see, was responsible for 30 years till the Orthodox came around to the prenuptial agreements. We'll get to all this, but I think you'll enjoy what I'm going to show you now. Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport, Rabbi Moshe's grandson-in-law, Rav Tendler's son-in-law. Here's the video of him examining the swordfish. Let me play it for you. I don't know why I'm not getting the sound.
It's not
I'm going to have to pull it up again right now because you want to see this. I'll pull it up and that'll be the last thing I think we do. And then, yes, okay, now you're going to be able to see it. Hold on. Okay, hold on. Now it's going to play. Let me pull it up for you. That's for some reason on Zoom. If you leave a video for too long, it you lose it. But here it is. Watch this. Oops.
So okay, so here it's full. He has all along the belly. Mm-hmm.
Danny, do you remember where they are?
I think
it's, I don't know what he wrote in the end.
So listen, Meachos, that's a scale, right? Let me see.
Okay. So there you see it. Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport saying about a swordfish. 100% it's kosher, not 95%, 100%. So let's leave that in abeyance. Let's continue with what we are doing. Actually, I have one more minute. Let me tell you, show you one more thing about the Harry Fishel Institute. And then I'll get back to the Shabbos tshuva. I have information, people emailed me about the driving on Shabbos. I just want to show you something which someone sent me. Believe it or not, look who gave a shiur at the, this comes from Dovi Safir, but someone sent it to me. Rav Soloveitchik, when he went to the land of Israel in 1935, when Lieberman was the head of it then, he gave a shiur at Harry Fishel. So, let us return now to what we're going to do. Incidentally, I should also say that someone from the family wants me to emphasize there's some other important books they published. So, for instance, this one, Tosfos HaShalim, which is all on Torah. They collect all the different Balei Tosfos. They've also published Birkas Eliyahu, which is an important commentary on the Vilna Gaon's commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. But all of these things, they're not academic. They're important works, but they're not the sort of academic stuff that Lieberman was interested in. So I'm going to leave all the stuff, the other stuff for next class, including about, I contacted Rabbi Heshy Billet. I know the story behind, some of the story behind Rav Meir of Eisenstadt's grave, the Shabbos, the driving on Shabbos tshuva, Robert Gordis, what he had to say about it, and the details of who signed this tshuva. I want to explain this to you. Maybe we'll get to it today. Stuff about the traditional movement. I turned to Zev Elef about it. I have some good stuff about that. Stuff about the Mishnah Brura, the Chavetz Chaim, Lashon Hara. If the person doesn't know you said it, you have to ask Mechila, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of stuff. So I'm putting this away and I can spend the whole hour doing this at the end when we're done the class, maybe another five classes or so. If we have everything that's built up, then we'll get to it. I want to return now, because we always have good stuff in and of itself, with our story with the great Rav Shaul Lieberman. Let's pick up where we left off. If you recall, and everyone who wants to see the prior classes, because it's a new semester, you can go on the Torah in Motion website. It's very easy. If you want to walk and listen to it as you walk, very good. You can go on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and plug in Torah in Motion. And then when that comes up, just plug in my name, Mark Shapiro, and you'll come up with all the Torah in Motion talks. Or you can just YouTube, if you're just interested in Lieberman, not the last series or previous classes, just search on YouTube, Mark Shapiro, Shaul Lieberman. You'll get the five previous classes. And if you do that, you'll see the last class. The previous one is, and I keep referring to earlier classes. It's like we've been going now for, 14 years or something. So when I talk about what we've done previously, it could mean last semester, it could mean 5 years ago. And only a few of you have been with us all this time. So, but still, I like to make those references. The last thing we did is, I believe, is that Lieberman leaves Eretz Yisrael in June of 1940. He travels east, stops over in India, and then he makes his way to the United States from the Pacific side, Pacific Ocean. Now, originally, Lieberman was only supposed to come for a few years. In fact, the contract is only 1 year to be renewed. But this would turn into a permanent appointment. He would remain in the United States for the rest of his life, except for 1 year, as when he taught in Eretz Yisrael. Lieberman never imagined he was leaving Eretz Yisrael for good. We have letters of him, for example, to Sholem, and he has other comments he makes, that he always assumed that he'd be returning. After all, who leaves the land of Israel never to return permanently? So it was a temporary visit, but the temporary visit turned into much longer. Of course, his wife also was much more of an American, and she had a very important job. And he also had he loved teaching at the seminary, as we'll see. So there was reasons why he stayed here. In the 1960s, he actually mentions Spiro, they mentioned in the book Spiro and Shochet, that he wished to return to the land of Israel, but by then he felt a responsibility to Finkelstein. He, as we'll see, he had become the rector of the institution, that he didn't feel, Finkelstein was so good to him, he didn't feel he could leave him in the lurch. Now, he's appointed, when he comes here, as a professor, and what's the title? He's given this fancy title, not Magid Shir or Rosh Hashiva, anything like that. Professor of Palestinian Literature and Institutions. That's the fact that he's such an expert in Yerushalmi. So, I mean, they could have called him Professor of Babylonian Literature, because before he's an expert in Yerushalmi, he's an expert in the Bavli. But that's the title they gave him. Professor of Palestinian Literature and Institutions. If you look in the Spiro book on page 40, you have a letter, which is from 1941, less than a year after his arrival. And this is what Lieberman writes to Finkelstein. About that, Finkelstein tells him that we're now make you, you know, you, I want to make you a permanent member of the faculty. He says, it goes without saying that I consider it to be a great privilege to be able to spread the Torah in this grace house of learning under the present favorable circumstances, particularly when the head of the school happens to be a great scholar in the same branch of learning to which I devoted my life. But look what he says. I consider it a privilege to be able to spread the Torah. He sees himself as teaching Torah. As it's a religious angle as well, not just from a scholarly perspective. And as I said, he would remain the rest of his life here, except for 1 year where he taught at the Institute of Advanced Studies at Hebrew University. In 1959, he's appointed rector of the rabbinical school. That means now this is going to lead us to even more problematic from the Orthodox perspective, because he's not just teaching. The seminary has always had Orthodox teachers, but now he's giving the imprimatur, he's signing the smicha. So in a sense that he is really involved in the movement, despite the fact that he'll consistently claim he has nothing to do with the movement. He's just a Muhammad. He's just a Torah teacher. He didn't use the word Muhammad. Those who know Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous line where he says, I'm a Muhammad. So that's what Lieberman was saying, is I'm a teacher of Torah. The Rav liked using the term Muhammad. So he's involved in administration, although Finkelstein, he tries to shield him as much as he can. Because what, Lieberman's going to spend his time doing busy work? That's what administrators do often. And Lieberman should be learning and should be writing. But as part of the agreement making him the rector of the institution, his job was, quote, to guide the general religious policy of the institution. You'll find that in Spiro on page 28. So on the one hand, you could say that's a good thing. He's guiding it. On the other hand, then again, that opens him up, and I think fairly, to Orthodox critique, that if things were happening that were not in line with what the Orthodox said, he has to have some responsibility, if that's his job, to guide the general religious policy of the institution. But the old question is, which we'll see, is was there anything at the seminary in opposition to Orthodoxy? That is, in terms of the rabbinical school, were they teaching things against halacha? We know that the rabbis were doing things against halacha. We know the rabbinical assembly was doing things against halacha. But can you point to things at the rabbinical institution, the rabbinical school? There's this weird connection. The seminary is an independent academic institution that also trains rabbis, but it has its own administration, and it functions separately than the rabbinical assembly and the rabbis outside in the field. So we'll see how this plays out as well. But the first thing we need to do is speak about the Orthodox response from Lieberman coming to the seminary. I'm going to summarize and add new material to material that's in my little book here. I call it my Kuntress, Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. Where did this come from? Well, first of all, this is how I introduce it. On April 18, 2005, I was privileged to deliver the annual Saul Lieberman Memorial Lecture, sponsored by the Union for Traditional Judaism. I thank all those who made the event possible, especially Rabbis Kenneth Green and Ronald Price. And I see Rabbi Kenneth Green is right here on the screen with us. So he and Ronald Price get the credit for this work, which I had so much fun writing, and University of Scranton Press sold like 1,000 copies of these. I give it away free now, and it's it was great. So the opportunity, I was asked to speak. I wasn't even asked to speak about the relationship to the Orthodox. Just, I guess, because I read about Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, and Lieberman is also that sort of figure between two worlds. But I had always seen over the years references in the Orthodox, and I thought, well, this will give me a good opportunity to speak about the attitude of the Orthodox. And then I decided to put it together in a little volume, including an English Hebrew section. You can get this, as I said, for $6 on Amazon. And or if you see me, I'll give it to you for free. Really enjoyed writing it. So let's speak a little bit about that. And to this day, constantly people are speaking to me about Lieberman and the Orthodox. And sometimes they know nothing. There's this, he'll remain nameless, but a rabbi, he's got to be like in his 80s right now. When I was at his shul, he even said to me, did Lieberman know Bavli or only Yerushalmi? I mean, just think of that. And then you'll meet people from the yeshiva world who know a lot, who they have all the svarim. But you'll meet some other people who are so ignorant. It's a yakam dor chadash. They think that Shaul Lieberman, that maybe he knew a little, you know, but what could he really know anything after all? He taught at the seminary, and I know conservative rabbis, and they're amaratzim. So, their attitude is that a typical guy at Lakewood, 22-year-old guy, knows more than this so-called Shaul Lieberman. And if I tell these people, I say to them, I'm going to tell you something right now, and don't take my word for it. Ask your Rosh Hashiva, he'll agree. Shaul Lieberman knows more than anyone in Lakewood now, any of the Rosh Hashiva, and I'll say that even during the days of Ravaron, in terms of just sheer knowledge. And I say they will agree with me if you ask them. I'm not talking about Lumbus, but in terms of, we're living in a new generation. But when Lieberman came to the seminary, remember, he was the great Eloi from Jerusalem. The one who learned Becharusa with Rav Kook, who was close to all the Gedolim, who was head of the Harry Fisher Institute, which was the Beit Midrash for what's thought to be the best and the brightest of the Talmud scholars in Eretz Yisrael, who had an academic sense. And now he's coming to the seminary at the same time, as we'll soon see, that there's a battle going on in the United States between Orthodoxy and conservatism. By coming to the seminary, Lieberman, he might not have realized this when he made the decision to come when he was in Eretz Yisrael, but he was in America, it wasn't that long before he realized it. And he did understand that it would be a little bit problematic. I'll explain to you why in a second. But his relationship with the Orthodox would forever be changed, in the sense that you no longer will have a Sfarim in a typical yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva might have it, but it'll have it hiding maybe in the corner, things like that. It was also... Orthodoxy's loss is a major, if you're going to term it that way, is a major coup for the seminary. For its Talmud faculty now towered over any other institution. any other academic institution. And you had it all the, you used to have Hebrew colleges then, and you have, of course, you have Hebrew University, and you have the rabbinical schools in America. They all have academic Talmudists. But to have Ginsburg and to have Lieberman in one place, they really are. And not to mention Finkelstein, that becomes the center for the study of Talmud. But Finkelstein wasn't done yet. Believe it or not, after World War II, when Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg is in Switzerland, in Montreal, Finkelstein turns to Weinberg and invites Weinberg to come. Finkelstein would spare no effort to bring the best scholars in. And Weinberg writes, he writes this to Shmuel Atlas, another academic Talmudist, who was first at Hebrew Union College and then later in, first in New York, Jewish Institute of Religion, where Shubo graduated from, and later at Hebrew Union College. You could graduate Jewish Institute of Religion, become a Reform rabbi or a conservative rabbi. Weinberg writes to Atlas, why does Finkelstein want me to come to the seminary? He already has two great figures, Ginsburg and Lieberman. But well, Yechiak of Weinberg, he wasn't going to sever his ties with the Orthodox world, so he would not go. But you understand why Finkelstein would turn to Rabbi Weinberg. If Lieberman, who wasn't just an Orthodox figure, he was a Rosh Yeshiva, close to all the Gedolim, if he agreed to come to the seminary, then maybe Rabbi Weinberg would. Lieberman made it his goal to bring in Dafka Orthodox scholars to the seminary. He asked many people. He asked Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung. This is recorded in the Spiro book. I even heard it from Dr. Judah, who I think needs a refuah shlema, Rabbi Kelman said in Toronto. But the Rabbi Hirschsprung's son-in-law, Rabbi Hirschsprung, Dr. Judah was quite close to Shaul Lieberman. He told me they once in Florida, Shaul Lieberman vacationed with them together in Florida. Rabbi Price, as I recall, he also asked him. Diane Grunfeld of London. Lieberman, Rabbi Epstein. What's his name? From
Isidore Epstein, right?
No, not Isidore Epstein. The grandson-in-law of
from Rabbi England.
From Queens, from Shara Torah.
That I don't know.
Rabbi, someone will do it in the comments. Rabbi Zelig Epstein. He's the only one who defended Rav Nosson Kamenetsky publicly. He asked Rav Zelig Epstein. So Lieberman wanted to get all the different Gedolim to come. Almost all of them said no, but he was successful. He did bring some in. He brought in Dimitrovsky. We spoke about Dimitrovsky. He brought in Shraga Abramson. Shraga Abramson comes from the same town in Europe as Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, Chechanovich, expert on the Gaonim, but he knew everything. His son-in-law, incidentally, is Elisha Anshelovitz. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's a well-known teacher in Eretz Yisrael. I think he's at, is he Malag Gaboa? I'm not sure. Eliezer Shimshon Rosenthal, although I don't believe Eliezer Shimshon Rosenthal was permanent. Maybe he was. So maybe someone at the seminary can recall that. I think he just would come on occasion. So hold on a second. I'll show you a picture of. Here he is. And Lieberman was actually quite close to Rosenthal. And when Rosenthal died, he died young. He was in the middle of working. I have it here. He was working on this volume. Can you see it? Yerushalmi Nezikin, from a new manuscript. He died. So while Lieberman finished it off, Lieberman has a whole commentary here on Yerushalmi Nezikin, based on this manuscript, Baba Matsya, Baba Kama. So he's a Torah Derech Eretz person. He taught at the seminary. Although Professor Sperber told me that when the seminary tried to get him to come, this maybe is later, I think. This would have been the 70s. This maybe explains Lieberman's answer. He spoke to Lieberman about it, and Lieberman told it, it's not for you. So I think perhaps by the 70s, Lieberman already saw the direction the seminary is going, so he advised someone like Sperber, this isn't a place for you. We have already mentioned, although Lieberman, as far as I know, had nothing to do with this, Abraham Sofer, the person who published the Me'iri, that's in every single yeshiva in the world, has the Me'iri. I'd have to get up and get it, so I don't need to show you. Take my word for it. He published it. It's on the opening. You open up, it's by Avraham Sofer. Look in the end of Chibur HaTshuva. You even have Agon Levi Ginsberg's notes there. He taught at the seminary, although the supposedly, because of his family's strong opposition historically to rabbinical seminaries in Hungary, they hated rabbinical seminaries. He only would teach in the Teachers Institute, but he taught women Gemara. How do I know this? Because Halivni told me he used to substitute for Sofer, and he would teach women Gemara. I don't think his ancestors who were opposed to rabbinical seminary would have been so crazy about him teaching women Gemara, but he taught in the Teachers Institute, but he taught at the seminary. So you had many, many Orthodox figures teaching at the seminary. Nevertheless, it was a time of increased battles. What was the battles? Well, because at this time, both Orthodoxy, what does it mean Orthodoxy? Orthodox synagogues that belong to the OU. The synagogues might look identical. We're going to speak about this as well. But institutionally, Orthodoxy versus conservative Judaism were competing for the loyalty of a large segment of the American Jewish community. What do I mean by the synagogues with the identical? Finkelstein. Finkelstein comes out of the seminary. He graduates from the seminary. He becomes rabbi, I think, in 1919 at a synagogue. It's called Kehilat Israel. I think that's what's called in the Bronx. It has a machitza. It's an Orthodox synagogue for all intents and purposes. And that's not the only one. There are other synagogues like that. These synagogues, they interviewed musmachim from both the seminary and from Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Yochanan. Whoever they liked better, they took them. And the service was the exact same. Everything was the same. But the synagogue then would join, let's say, the United Synagogue. I don't know, maybe Knesset Israel. I always called an Orthodox synagogue because that's how it's always called, because the women sat up in the balcony. But if that was a member of the United Synagogue, which I haven't been able to determine, then it would be a conservative synagogue. A conservative synagogue is allowed to have machitz also. And what was the difference here? In terms of how most of the synagogues functioned, there wasn't much of a difference. And then you're going to tell me again, well, the conservative synagogue could have mixed seating. But we'll see. I'm going to give you the figures today. The Orthodox synagogues also had mixed seating. So there was if you look, let's say, in the 10s and the 20s, a lot of similarities. In the 30s, of course, I mentioned Bernard Drachman. Bernard Drachman, I think I might have implied that he was working at the seminary when he was president of the OU. It's not the case. He leaves in 1909, which is still fairly early. Chaimson remained there. He was the rabbi of the Orthodox synagogue, and he was teaching there. But supposedly, Drachman already in 1909 saw that he didn't like the way he was moving as a conservative institution. Now, I don't know if that's the case or if there was conflict with Zalman Schachter. Whatever the case is, there wasn't that much different. And you could go to a conservative synagogue, you can go to an Orthodox synagogue, but these were competing institutions. And the ideology of the seminary with Zalman Schachter, for instance, Catholic Israel versus Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Yochanan, which is really yeshiva. There would be differences there. So you see that you want to grab the loyalty of the people. What happens in the 30s, though, is something new, brand new. The conservative rabbinate had recently begun to assert its independence in terms of halakha. They never did this before. They never were deciding halakha questions. That you went to Poskim. Conservative rabbis went to Poskim either. They can go to Ginsburg, or they can go to the local rabbi who's a Talmud Chacham from Europe. Many of these conservative rabbis could go to their fathers. Louis Finkelstein go to his father, Rav Shmuel Yitzchak Finkelstein, the big Rav. Israel Leventhal, leading conservative rabbi, he can go to his father, Bernard Leventhal, the leading Rav of Philadelphia. Do you know how many Orthodox rabbis had children who went to the seminary? So a real connection. But what do I mean when they started asserting its halakhic decision-making? I believe you first see this with the issue of the Aguna. The Aguna was a problem already after World War I. There's all sorts of upheavals. It was a problem even before that. If you look at the Hebrew newspapers from the 19th century, Hamagid and all the rest of them, almost uniformly, every week you'll have an ad there. My husband left, coming from the village, Novozipkov, let's say. My husband left 6 months ago. He went to America. He hasn't been heard from since, my daughter's husband departed. We haven't seen him in 2 years. You have all these stories. Someone needs to go through these newspapers and try to see if they can come up with some sort of article here describing the situation, how they tried to solve the Aguna problem. But by the 1930s, the conservative rabbinate feels that the difference between them and the Orthodox rabbinate is that the Orthodox rabbinate is old-fashioned, they're European, they're too conservative. They're not willing to use halacha, to speak frankly, to use halacha the way modern Orthodox rabbis today use halacha. Nothing the conservative rabbis were saying were out of the fold. What's out of the fold is that they did not accept what the Gedolim in the end said, but they were doing exactly what modern Orthodoxy said that we should be doing. That is working within a halachic system. That was what's going on in Germany, and it's been going on since there's been a modern Orthodox movement. That's why if you look at early conservative Judaism, and we'll see when we finish and we go on to a new semester after. That won't be the next semester. I want to do the early reform movement. The first generation reformers also have a lot in common with modern Orthodoxy. If you read their descriptions of what they're trying to do, they sound just like Rabbi Norman Lamb would sound 40 years later. But what was the first, what I think is the first example of this? Rabbi Louis Epstein. Well, let me show you who Rabbi Louis Epstein is. I couldn't find a picture of him. Believe it or not, I could not find a picture of Louis Epstein online, but you have lots of articles. This is his father. Rabbi Louis Epstein's father, Louis Epstein, when his father comes to America, becomes a leading rabbi in Chicago, not to be confused with Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. I'm not sure if they're related, but Louis Epstein remained in Slobodka, where he learned. Yeah, you can see lots of articles on him. So it says, for example, he becomes rabbi after graduating the seminary. He's in Dallas, Ohio, and then he's in Roxbury, Beis Midrash HaGadol in Roxbury. Beis Midrash HaGadol certainly had a machitza. What's better Beis Midrash HaGadol in 1918 doing hiring a guy from the seminary? Because again, they would interview people from the seminary and they'd interview people from Yeshivas Reb Tzalchanan. The religious makeup was identical often. I mentioned Bernhard Drachman. Bernhard Drachman studied in the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau, which is the German equivalent of the seminary in New York. And then he becomes rabbi of Kehilat Israel in Brooklyn. Kehilat Israel still exists. I don't know if when he became rabbi, what the situation was with men and women sitting together or separate without a machitza. It would be interesting to know. Soon is a synagogue where men and women are sitting together, but he becomes rabbi of KI, a leading, probably in those days, the leading conservative synagogue in the area. He publishes a little booklet in 1930 called Hatza'ah Lema'an Takanat Agunot, a proposal to free the Agunot. So we don't want there to be all these Agunos. Husbands disappear. For many Orthodox rabbis, even talking about Hatzah proposal to free Agunos shows you that you're a reformer. I mean, that's even today, the Haredi world, for many of them, any discussion of it. But we all know in the modern Orthodox world, there is a Hatzah. There's the RCA prenuptial agreement, which I'm going to argue was delayed for so many years precisely because of these internal disputes. If it wasn't for the long shadow of Lieberman and the rejection of his ketubah, Orthodoxy would have adopted this solution long before. And it existed in Morocco already 30 years before. In fact, wait, I'll tell you it now and we'll get back to it. Norman Lamb, not just Norman Lamb, actually not Norman Lamb, others, Rabbi Yaakov Levinson, as I recall, and others, in their criticism of the Lieberman ketubah, say, how can you have such a stupid thing? Man and woman are about to get married and you're speaking about what's going to happen if they get divorced. They thought it was idiotic. And that's exactly what we all do. But it shows you this, they had to oppose anything that came from the conservative, even if it made sense, even if it was a good idea. You can argue. So Lieberman maybe have a different proposal, but since it came from the conservative, they had to reject it. And bas mitzvah in the modern Orthodox, not just the modern Orthodox, lots of people have bat mitzvahs. When the bat mitzvah was first proposed, of course, the Orthodox had to condemn it and say it's terrible because it didn't come from the Orthodox. That's a common phenomenon at which we will see. Had Epstein not got involved with this, maybe the Orthodox would have been able to come up with a solution. He later would publish, however, a large book on this, which is still available on HebrewBooks.org. They haven't taken it down, fortunately. Oops, and it's here it is. Oh, sorry. Here it is. L'Shelas Haguna, an entire volume of, 258 pages. And he includes here also something from a Sephardic rabbi from Jerusalem, Ben Zion Alkali, who also has a similar approach. Between his first Hatzah in 1930 and this volume in 1940, and this is also on HebrewBooks.org, incredibly. I downloaded it because as soon as someone informs them that this is from Knesiat HaRabbanim HaAmerikayim, Shabbat Midrash HaRabbanim, that's the rabbinical assembly. This is not Orthodox. They'll take it down. But look where it comes from, this book. It comes from the library of Chabad, because in Chabad library, a great library in Crown Heights, they collect everything. And this comes from their library. So this was published in 1936. And what is in this volume? This is the rabbinical assembly is adopting the Hatzah of 1930, which Louis Epstein goes into great detail in his 1940 book. What is the Hatzah? That at the time of marriage, the husband will appoint his wife as his shaliach, as his agent. So if he ever disappears, she is his shliach, and she will appoint a sofer, will instruct the Beis Din to write a get. There were a number of proposals. They call them Kiddushin al-Tanai, you know, marriage al-Tanai. It's not really al-Tanai, but because you know you're allowed to appoint someone as your agent to write a get. So here you appoint someone to write a get. And then if you disappear, she has this authority. It's been done through the Beis Din, and she can appoint them. And the rabbinical assembly in that booklet, which I just showed you, at their convention, they said that we are going to adopt this proposal. Everyone should adopt this proposal, and this will solve the problem. Now, the proposal never got off the ground, despite what the rabbinical assembly said, because Louis Ginsburg opposed it, and also Michael Higger. Michael Higger was a Talmudist at the seminary, also typical yeshiva bacher who ends up at the seminary. He published all these little masechtas, Masechta Sofrim, Sefer Torah, the minor masechtas, which are post-Talmudic. He published them, and they're the standard editions. They were opposed to it. Now, why were they opposed to it? As far as I know, we don't have in writing why they're opposed to it. There's two reasons you could be opposed to it. Either because it'll create a split between the Orthodox world and the conservative world, because if the Orthodox world starts challenging the yichus, the lineage of the conservatives, that'll split the Jewish people. And there's also halachic reasons to be opposed, quite apart from the polemical reasons. And these halachic reasons, you find them in an entire volume that was published by a Agudas Rabbanim in America before Epstein's 1940 book, but after the proposal came out and the rabbinical assembly adopted it, called Dor Acharon, which hundreds of rabbis sign on. You have Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski and Rav Cook, all opposing this proposal. There are Orthodox rabbis who suggested similar things. The problem with all these proposals is after it's written, if the husband then sleeps with his wife, it could void the whole thing, and there's other halachic problems. I don't want to get into the halachic disputes because really, it's soon, if you read the arguments in the book, it doesn't even become a halachic issue. It's the idea of the chutzpah. As Rabbi Joseph Konvitz, he was the president of Agudas Rabbanim, the son-in-law of the Ridbaz, says in L'dor Acharon, he says that the students from Schechter Seminary, that's what they used to call the seminary, they called it Schechters, he says that they have no shaychus, no connection to Rabbanus and to Psak. That is, who are these people who spent a few years studying at the seminary? They're going to decide what is halacha. Now, granted, Epstein was a Talmud Chacham. Everyone acknowledged this in my booklet here, and also in an article in Yeshurin. The authors cite correspondence with Louis Epstein had with lots of Gedolim. He sent it to them, and they corresponded with him. But for the rabbinical assembly, they're going to be deciding halacha, to decide to change the way Jewish marriage law operates, you need to go to the Gedol Yisrael. You can't go to any local rabbi, not even a local Orthodox rabbi. Never mind going to rabbis who are from Schechter Seminary. So here, by the mid-30s already, you have a break because you have conservative rabbis saying, well, it's not just that we're more open-minded and that we're the future because we're English-speaking and all that. No, they are willing. They say they're willing to make changes in halacha. When I say make changes in halacha, I'm not talking about eating swordfish or anything like that. I'm talking about the most significant thing you can speak about, actual marriage, where if someone, you think you're divorced and you're not divorced, that creates an adulterous situation and children mamzerim. where do they get the chutzpah to make decisions like that? So the Orthodox rabbinate decided it was when Shuriv Rabbi is just ministering at synagogues, they were not a threat. But now that they're putting themselves out as an alternative center of authority, that's when they need to be shut down. And the Agudas Rabbanim in America, which is fighting the battle, they're on the front lines. And they're already seeing in the 30s conservative synagogues without machitzas. Now, granted, their synagogues don't have machitzas either, many of them, the Orthodox synagogues, but the conservative rabbis are starting to justify it and saying that it's permissible. The Orthodox rabbis weren't justifying it. It was like, Nebuch, what can you do? But we don't want to lose these shuls, so we'll keep an Orthodox rabbi there. But I'll read to you what Louis Ginsberg has to say about machitzas in a minute. And then they get the rabbis from all over the world sign on to it. So the battle, there's now a battle between the old-fashioned rabbis, not just the old-fashioned, Rabbi Zev Gold signed the document as well. All the Orthodox rabbis, I would say, in America, led by the old-fashioned, the Agudas Rabbanim rabbis, but they're the real Talmidei Chachamim from Europe, against the conservative movement. And lo and behold, what happens? Right during this conflict, Shaul Lieberman, who is from the old-style Talmidei Chachamim, he shows up in New York, and now he's giving, he's not like Ginsberg. Ginsberg had left the Torah world, as it's understood in Orthodoxy. And Lieberman shows up at the seminary. Now, why did the conservative rabbis think that they could involve themselves in halachic matters like this? I found, I went through to when I did Shaul Lieberman Orthodox, every day I would devote an hour to going through Hapardes. Hapardes is the monthly. It came out every single month. Hapardes is great. Because it had just the advertisements and the discussions. I'm going to be using this an enormous amount if I ever get around to my book on the halachic history of the United States. I'm going to have to deal with the whole machitza business as well, halachic disputes. I'll get to the machitza in a little while. I have some good stuff to show you. But Hapardes would come out every month, and that was the journal, the Torah journal of the Agudas Rabbanim, and all the Gedolim wrote it. That's where Soloveitchik wrote his first pieces. When his father wanted to show him show the world who his son, the great Gaon, is, he published pieces in Hapardes. And you had editorials in Hapardes. The best thing about Hapardes are the ads, I think. You have, like, for things today we wouldn't dream of eating, the different gelatin products, all these things. In my next farm blog post, I'm going to have a whole discussion about this. And I'll use pictures from Hapardes, but Hapardes has editorials in which the editor, first was Rabbi Pardes, later becomes Rabbi Simcha Elberg. That's why it's called Hapardes, because it was Rabbi Shmuel Pardes. He was a Rav in Chicago. He was the editor, and this is what he explains. Listen to this. So every day I'd go through, every day I had a chance, an hour going through all the Hapardeses. And that's, if you notice in the book, when I'm quoting different things from Hapardes, how do I know all this? Because I'd go through it, and it was full of information about the Orthodox conservative dispute. And also the dispute between Agudas Rabbanim and the OU. Agudas Rabbanim was saying that you can't trust the OU hashkacha. How can you eat the OU? OU synagogues don't have machitzas. You can eat OU hashkacha? How is that possible? So you see, you learn an enormous amount about Orthodoxy. The sort of information that if you look at Gurok's wonderful book on Orthodoxy in America, he doesn't access that. That's not the sort of thing he's interested in. So there's still room, especially since I want to focus on halacha. I've already done I'm too busy with other stuff, but I've done about 25 pages on conversion in America and the different approaches in America to the rabbis of conversion. So there's a lot to do. But getting back to this Hapardes. So the Hapardes of the Torah says as follows. It asks the question, where do the conservative rabbis think that they can decide halakha questions? Quote, we, that is us, Rabbanim, we must confess and say we are guilty. They are found among us rabbis who respect them, who come together with them to be Masadar Kiddushin or at other gatherings. So Rabbi Pardes is saying that we have Orthodox rabbis who will jointly be Masadar Kiddushin with a conservative rabbi. I'm going to show you a picture in a minute to make you see this. There are those of us who enter their synagogues. I can tell you that in Scranton, Rabbi Guterman, he'd come occasionally and do bechinas at YU. He's an old Sobotka Rav. He comes to Scranton. He's in Scranton like 50 years. There's a picture of him in the JCC because he was beloved, but he refused to step foot in the synagogue, the conservative synagogue. There are those of us, listen to this, there are those of us who educated our children in their seminary. I don't know what that means. I mean, there's a lot of people who, a lot of children of these rabbis who went to the seminary. I don't know what it means that we educated. The reality is the children went. I don't think the fathers were so happy, but it doesn't mean they all were so unhappy. So, for example, Rabbi Geffen, famous Rabbi Geffen from Atlanta, who gives the hashgacha on Coca-Cola. Well, he has a bunch of grandchildren who became conservative rabbis. He went to the smicha. At least he went to one of the smicha at the seminary. The sense was that many of the old-time rabbis, they came to terms with the fact that their children were going in a more liberal route. Rabbi Ephraim Epstein from Chicago, his son, Harry Tzvi, he learns in Hebron, in Eretz Yisrael, in Hebron, comes back to America, becomes, there's an Orthodox Musmach, becomes a conservative rabbi. It was the era, and they became much more accepting of it. There are those of us who educated our children in their seminary, and this is what brought about their chutzpah, to establish themselves as rabbis, to rule in halachot of Gittin and Kiddushin. In other words, the Orthodox rabbis are treating them like colleagues. They're being Masada Kiddushin with them. So can you blame the conservative rabbis for thinking, we too can decide halacha? I want to show you, since he mentions being Masada Kiddushin, I have this picture just because I've had it for a little while. I wanted to show you walking down the aisles. Remember, I showed you the rabbis walking down the aisle, but it just occurred to me as I'm speaking, it's not just walking down the aisle. I can show you something else. I got to pull it up again. Hold on. Where is it? Hold on. You're going to want to see this. I just got to pull it up on the computer. Unless I have it here for you. I have it here for you. Here, let me show you. It was an article about a year ago or something. No, more than a year ago. How many years ago was it? Oh, it was 7 years ago in the Jewish Link. But look at this picture. The article is How to Love by an Orthodox Jew. He claims to be right-wing Orthodox. How to Love Conservative Reform Hasidic Reconstructionist Jews. And he shows a picture of his wedding. And here you have in the middle the Boston Rebbe. That on the right is Rabbi Pinchas Stolper from the OU. And that on the left, his name is Rabbi Stanley Steinhardt from the Jericho Jewish Center. I don't know him, but he's a conservative rabbi. Now here, what's interesting, first of all, they're walking down the aisle. I told you this already, that they used to walk down the aisles before the chuppah. And I'd like to know when this stopped. And are there any weddings today where we give the rabbis the kavod of walking down the aisle? I haven't seen it. Now notice also, this is, I guess this would be the 60s. Still men and women, and you can see they're not the most Orthodox. If you look on the right, just look at the kippahs. They're the ones they grabbed when they came in. But men and women are sitting separately. But here you have the Boston Rebbe. Let me see if it says the year of his 1965. Yeah. So here you have the Boston Rebbe doing exactly what Apartheid says is the problem. He's being Masada Kiddushin together with the conservative rabbi. But I tell you, Edut Ne'emana, because I'm an eyewitness. I don't need to say the names, but I could tell if anyone's interested later. I was at a wedding where a conservative rabbi, the father of the groom, was Masada Kiddushin, and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who was related to the Kala. Either he was a witness or he read the ketubah. He was under the chuppah. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was he was even harsher against the conservative, at least in a polemical sense, than Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in Chicago refused to allow the non-Orthodox to use the mikvah for their conversions. And this created a huge dispute. The Telz Yeshiva held in Chicago, you could do it. And Rav Moshe Feinstein held that you could allow them if they contribute money or if it's going to create a conflict in the community, that sort of thing. What do we care if they use it? But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik thought it creates a falsehood to the Torah, and there was a whole machokas here, and the people went to Rav Moshe. After Rav Aaron said no, they went to Rav Moshe, and then the people behind this, as is reported by Rav Aaron's son in a volume published, was the people in the Telz Yeshiva, because I guess they didn't want to get into conflict with the non-Orthodox. So Rav Aaron was Masada Kiddushin together, so obviously he felt it wasn't such an issue. And even Hapardes, I tell you, and this is one of the great discoveries I found going through the Hapardes was also guilty. Why do I say Hapardes is guilty? Take a look at this. Hapardes, 1931. A little Torah note here. Who's the author of it? Eliezer Aryeh Halevi, Hamachuna Dr. Finkelstein, New York. This is Louis Finkelstein, at the time teaching at the seminary. He's a graduate of the seminary. He's publishing a Torah article in Hapardes. So he had been teaching. Not only had he taught at the seminary since 24, he was the president of the rabbinical assembly from 28 to 1930, and Hapardes published his piece. So you're going to say, well, maybe they did it as a favor to his father, who was a well-known Rav in New York. Doesn't matter. Hapardes is publishing Chidushei Torah from someone identified with the conservative movement. So this shows us and how things were, and that the so-called guilt is completely understandable, because as we will see, and we're going to focus on this at least the beginning of next class, the designation Orthodox and conservative doesn't denote, there's no real fundamental difference among most American Jews and most American congregations, even among many of the rabbis. It's hard to know the difference. And it's precisely the Epstein proposal and the fact that the conservative movement, at least the rabbis, said that they're going to independently begin to make all the decisions, that finally opens up the eyes of the Orthodox rabbis that although our synagogues look the same, there is a difference. And that this movement, which wasn't really a movement, but now they're starting to seeing it as a sort of breakaway, that this is dangerous. But my argument in Sol Liebman and the Orthodox, which subsequently I became convinced of it even more through other pieces of evidence, is that until the mid-1930s, the Epstein proposal, there was no understanding that this is a heretical group. Yeah, you have people who are doing things we don't like, but this isn't a group that we need to battle. On the contrary, the thinking is that we could live with them, especially the traditionalists among them. There's good conservative, there's not. But now all of a sudden the conservative movement, the whole conservative movement, even if you're a conservative rabbi who's completely Shomer Torah mitzvos, you are going to now be grouped as belonging to a sectarian heterodox group. And then we can really speak about a new denomination, conservative Judaism. We'll have three denominations then: Orthodoxy, Conservative, Reform. We'll talk about Reconstructionism later, because one of the leaders of conservative Judaism is actually Mordechai Kaplan. So that's the argument of Sol Liebman and the Orthodox, that the Epstein proposal is what really creates the break. And really, it forces the Orthodox to recognize that this is a different denomination with a different approach. But this is before the driving to shul on Shabbos tshuva. It's before electricity. It's before a lot of things. It's a time when the differences were very minor, and the Orthodox rabbis never imagined that the conservative rabbis would make far-reaching halachic decisions. Just like the typical Orthodox rabbi doesn't make halachic decisions, he goes to the poskim, so too the conservative rabbis go. So we will pick up with that next class. We'll speak about more, especially taking us into the 50s, what's with this orthodoxy and what's an orthodox shul then if you don't have a machitza? I'll speak more about traditional Judaism, I'll read you some of the material from Louis Ginsberg, because it's quite interesting what he has to say about mixed seating. And then I'll show you a picture that one of the people who's with us has for me. You'll see how they davened at the seminary. And lots more good stuff. Let me now take some of the questions here. We did a lot today. And again, I still have to get to some of the... I'm going to get to this next week, Billy Neder. One of you wants to know why I quote Daniel Boyarin. Why I haven't put him in Chayrim, and that he can't be quoted because of his politics. And his politics are abhorrent. But I will explain to you why, not just myself, Tablet, which is right wing, why. And I also claim that he's not the problem. Peter Beinart. I'll talk about Peter Beinart next week. But let me get to the questions. Someone privately emails me that we lost Rav David Eliach. From Yeshiva Flatbush, Thursday night, 99 years old, the husband of Yaffa Eliach, the great author of the wonderful book. If you haven't read it, Shabbos Reading, Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. It's so classic. Then, of course, she wrote a book on Aishishuk. That's her town. I brought her to University of Scranton once to speak about her relationship with the Pope. She had a relationship with Pope John Paul II. She had a relationship with, and it's a brilliant family. I actually have to, I should say now, Hakara Tatov to Rabbi Eliach. When I did not have a job, when I came out of Harvard Graduate School for the first year, I didn't have a job. So I thought maybe I teach at one of the schools in the New York area, one of the yeshivas. After all, I'm a Harvard PhD. I can teach Jewish history and things like that. And what I'm going to say now is, I guess, an indictment maybe of our day school, of our high schools then. I'm not saying now. This is 1995. I sent my resume out to every single Orthodox high school in the New York area, and only two of them replied to me. Here I am, Harvard PhD, Musmach, writing that only two of them. One was Ramaz, and the other was Yeshiva Fesh. And although the problem was I couldn't teach yeshiva, I told Rabbi Eliach that typically yeshiva guy, he basically offered me the job right there, but he said I have to teach him Ivrit. And I said to him, I have to be honest, my Ivrit is, I can speak maybe a little Lashon HaKodesh, but Ivrit is the way he wants it. I don't think I could do it. So his attitude was, well, then come back to me when you know Ivrit. Ramaz, of course, had no problem. But the fact that to me was very disappointing, because not even to interview me, not even to talk to me. What are all these schools you have in New York area? Don't they want to impress their parents that say that now teaching in our Jewish history is Mark Shapiro, Harvard PhD? I would think that that would be, but whatever. Yeah, it's a loss. Rabbi Yaakov Yellen says that you say Ramosha was not afraid either. I think so, generally. And we know that the Satmar, the terrible stuff they did to him, he was never afraid about that tshuva. 100% not about that tshuva. But I, as a Talmud of his, okay, so I take your word that he was not afraid either. But if you read the Masoras Moshe, there are some times there where you get the sense that he didn't want to mess with some of these crazies. And his attitude was, we don't need to mess with them. Maybe it's just a personality thing. Rabbi Tendler, maybe he enjoyed messing with them. I don't know. But the issue of Chakira, the one that just came out, the last one, the latest one, whatever it is, it's here. Volume 30. I was so
responded.
Volume 30, summer 2021. There's three things from the Rav here, four things. Rabbi Soloveitcher's remark at the Chanukah Sabbath, the Talmud Shtibel, the Rav at Revel, the Rav at Ritz, Rabbi Soloveitcher's portrayal of the patriarchs. I was so inspired when I read this. I have a lot of letters of the Rav. Well, I shouldn't say a lot, like 10 significant letters, which I've discovered over the years. And I had said that I was going to publish them in Israel. There's a journal edited by Dov Schwartz. Dov Schwartz is one of these people who published an enormous amount. I think he has two books on the Rav, but they published a number of letters of the Rav. But after seeing this, I'd rather publish it in Chakira, which is read by thousands of people, than publish it in a journal put up by, an annual put up by Bar Ilan, which only some academics see. So I told the Chakira people that I'm going to be sending them these letters. Yeah. You can believe it. I won't tell which archive because I don't want someone to scoop me, but the place I found it, they want to charge me 120 shekels. I guess that's $40 or something. 120 shekels, whatever it is, to publish each document. I'll tell you what 120 shekels is. $37 for each document. I think that's outrageous. The job of a library, especially if you're an archive at a library or an archive anywhere, is supposed to find, if you make copy pages, you pay, but to charge for your holdings at the library there are supposed to be for the public. And so I have 10 letters here and they want to charge me. So I'll get the money from the University of Scranton. Okay, I'll get it from them. But still, I think that's outrageous. 120 shekels. For this, Rav Shabtai is married to, I know he's married to Rav Tendler's daughter. I've showed the wedding picture already. I didn't know which one because I don't know the family really well. All I can say is kol kavod to Chakira. They're able to consistently come out with very interesting issues. So, Rabbi Shudnow says that he was together for a tenure in Newport, Rhode Island at the Navy. He and Rabbi Macy Gordon perform morality and values training for all chaplains. And Rabbi Lieberman and Finkelstein and Rafaur were my Wesa teachers. Yes. Rabbi Tenler was not so tolerant of people from even Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs from the seminary, though. He has a debate in tradition in the early 70s, I think it is, with Rabbi David Feldman. Rabbi David Feldman was a completely observant Jew, a Talmud Chacham of the first caliber, who educated his kids in accordance with traditional Orthodox values, the sons of Rosh Hashiva, not YU. When they have a debate about, if it's abortion or birth control, something like that, and Rabbi Tendler insists on referring to him as Reverend Feldman. So, but again, he's an equal opportunity, right? He would go after Orthodox rabbis also, certainly. Bilga Wirt says that Elisha is now associated with Emory. Shirim and Halacha Tshuvah Rishonim are remarkable. If he's associated with Emory, it's very recent, because as of last year, I believe, he still was in Israel. Rabbi Shudnow says in Chicago, the CRC and HTC created traditional synagogues. Yes, I'll speak about that next class because I'm going to talk about the phenomenon. And I'll tell you what Rabbi Elif told me about the traditional movement. I need to know about this because I want to write about it. Unfortunately, there's not much to write about, but he sent me, there's not much in written literature. I've expressed the assumption that a lot of these traditional synagogues, because they had Orthodox rabbis, would eventually turn Orthodox. But that could be just impressionistic. It needs to be documented that that's the case. So we will speak next class about this, and because then that becomes a breaking point also between Orthodox and conservative. Rabbi Kalman says, for many years, the Shari Shamayim in Montreal was conservative shul with a mechitza. It had conservative rabbis.
Was Orthodox. Rabbi Shushat, whose son you may know, he was the rabbi for many, many years. And then Barry Gelman was there temporarily.
So why do you call it, but it was associated with...
No, for many years it was, I believe, a member of the United Synagogue. Somebody says you're not, but I'm for 95% sure it's a member of the United Synagogue with the Mechitza.
And by the way, Rav Kook went to that synagogue, as I recall, when he came to Montreal in 19...
It's the most prestigious shul. It's Westmount. That's where all the fans, Bronfmans were members there. It's a very prestigious, beautiful shul.
Rabbi Shudnow says that the RA Committee on Jewish Law became the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. Standards meant non-halachic. Next class, I'm going to describe to you a little about the halachic tshuva. And we mentioned the Shabbos tshuva. We mentioned Rabbi Gordas, Robert Gordas, last class. I'll tell you what he wrote in response to this. And wait till you hear who wrote the tshuva, the three people who wrote the tshuva that permitted driving on Shabbos. One of them, just to whet your appetite, was not just a Talmud Mufhak of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who not only received smicha, who remained 2 extra years at Reitz to get a Yodin Yodin. Talmud Mufhak, the Rav was his Mesader Kiddushin. He learned with the Rav privately in Boston. Does anyone know who I'm talking about before I speak about next week? One of the three authors was considered one of the future greats of Orthodoxy, one of the most greatest Talmidei Chachamim to come out of Reitz in the Revel era, before he comes under the influence of Mordechai Kaplan in particular. So we will talk about his brother was professor at YU, professor of Jewish history, his younger brother. So we will get to him next class. So, yes, the first bat mitzvah is more like happens. Rabbi Kelman, today it's officially unaffiliated, though brands itself as Orthodox. I do not believe. Okay, you're speaking about the Montreal show. Yes, I know the book tradition and change. Yes. Professor Fa'ur Roshino says that senior Talmudists do not attend graduations at the seminary. That I didn't know. Rabbi Shudnow says that Rabbi Soloveitchik had to leave HTC when he refused to sign smichas of students who would take the traditional mixed seating shuls. That was definitely one of the things that led to the conflict. But I showed you some stuff about this last semester, if you remember. But I have all the private material about this. And there were other stuff as well. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik thought that as the Rosh Yeshiva, he should be in charge of everything. The problem was that, first of all, there's a president, and the president of HTC thought that he should be in charge. And there were also other rabbis there. You had other rabbis there, and they did not feel that that they should take orders from Rav Aaron. So it created a lot of controversy. And the signing, the allowing them to take shuls with mixed seating shuls, that was just added fuel to the fire. Someone privately texts me that in the Sefer, the Jubilee volume for Rav Shimon Shkup, there's a letter from Professor Davidson. Professor Davidson, who taught at the seminary, a great scholar of poetry, he raised a lot of money for Rav Shimon Shkup's yeshiva. As I recall, he went there, but Rav Shimon Shkup, when he came to America, even went to the seminary and to visit with him, and he helped him a great deal. So it makes sense. Justin Horton said, Rasovich had many friends, not of the rabbinic cadre. He was close to the Boston, Brooklyn, Bali, Bali, and cherished a friendship. Yes, but the difference is, when I said real friends, these were people who looked up to the Rav as the Gadol Ador. They would never call him by his first name. The Lieberman, I'm assuming, when they were private together, you call him Beryl. Although Rabbi Shudnow wouldn't call him by his first name either. But when you're at that level of the Rav, to have friends of the sort, those are the people you have in your youth. It's very hard when the people meet you, when you're already at that level, you can only really have close friends with people at your level. So these are tough, and they don't shoot the breeze either. It's not the same sort of thing. But Rabbi Shudnow, you read the way the Rav describes how he saw him as a loyal friend. Of course, Rabbi Shudnow was the one who wrote the only time that an English article appeared in Hapardes. See, Rabbi Rakefet some time ago gave a talk on this thing, and he said the only time a conservative rabbi appeared in Hapardes. It's not true. I just showed you Louis Finkelstein. But the only time you had an English piece in Hapardes was after the Rav was cleared by the judge in Boston. He had been accused of all sorts of shenanigans in Kashrus, was, by the way, Orthodox rabbis were instigators of this, including one name in particular that is pretty well known. Don't need to mention it right now, especially since later they apparently made shalom. But Rabbi Shubau was a big backer of Soloveitchik, and he wrote this long article there explaining how the Rav was being persecuted. These rabbis, these Orthodox rabbis, didn't want the Rav to come in and overshadow them and run the show, and also to clean up Kashrus. Kashrus was in a scandalous state, and the Rav was coming in to clean up Kashrus, and that would affect their Parnassa. So there were a group of Orthodox rabbis in Boston who, first of all, they resented this idea. The Rav was a number of shuls created a position. They called the Rav the chief rabbi of Boston. Who made the Rav chief rabbi of Boston? They think they're rabbi of Boston. So, Amalia asked, to please comment on the idea that Ezra Snashim in the Beis Hamikdash was not the women's section, but the social hall, so maybe there's no valid reason for the Mechitza, which doesn't seem to have agreed on dimensions. Wait till next class, because I will tell you about a well-known rabbi in America, a posek, an author of Sfarim, who argues basically similar to what you're saying, that you don't need a Mechitza, even in Dalvinin. He tries to provide a halachic justification, and wait till you hear what Ramosha Feinstein says to him. I'll do that next class. Rabbi Green, yeshivas are not impressed with Harvard degrees. Yes, but I wasn't sending to yeshivas. I was sending to these modern Orthodox high schools that call themselves yeshivas, but some of them are no different than prep schools. And they all, many of them, if you look at how they advertise themselves, they're more interested in advertising how many kids they get into the Ivy League schools than how they get into, than how many go to Israel. So it just shows, I think, that they're small thinking. Remember that Rabbi Green says, remember that Schechter and Finkelstein called the congregation organization United Synagogues, perhaps emulating what they recognize as modern orthodoxy in England. Perhaps. For them, it was an organization. It wasn't had nothing to do with ritual or anything like that. Rabbi Shudnow says, Rabbi Feldman and I were listed as Orthodox and Jewish values online, not only us. Rabbi Feldman, who I knew, not only did I know him, I spent Shabbos together with him, Torah in Motion. Should I say it? Torah in Motion had scholar in residence, myself and Rabbi Feldman. And spending Shabbos with Rabbi Feldman, and he spoke at the traditional synagogues, which they still have in Toronto, non-egalitarian. But what a delight to spend it with Rabbi Feldman.
We had him and his daughter and son. Rav Daniel came.
That was a different time. That was a different time.
Yeah.
I asked Rabbi Feldman, why did you go to the seminary? He already had Orthodox smicha. He came. His father was a big Rav. His father was a rabbi in Los Angeles, as I recall. His father wrote a sefer on the Torah Tamima. And Rabbi Feldman said to me that that's what we thought the future was. And I can tell you that by the end of his life, someone I know was at one of the rabbinical assembly conventions at one of the hotels, and they're talking about whatever they talk about. Rabbi Feldman gets up almost crying and saying, "What are you talking about? What about Shabbos? What about Kashrus? You know, this is what we should be speaking about." So we know we're going to get to the end of the story is that, and Lieberman is part of this story, that all these hopes and dreams, that this is the future and everything, with the Gerson Cohen assumption of authority and the changes in the seminary, that leads to the great break and the great disappointment that those conservative rabbis who were committed to halacha and saw the movement as a halachic movement, just maybe a little more lenient than the Orthodox, they're no longer was pretending anymore. And we have some of them with us online with us now. And of course, there's Rabbi Novak and there's Rabbi Halivni and Rabbi Faur. Well, he was not even part of it, but he could be his teacher of it. And so many others, they form the Union of Traditional Judaism, which I did not, we'll get to that. And there's the letter, which I published here in Sol Lieberman Orthodox, because they turned to their Rebbe, Rachel Lieberman. And Shaul Lieberman writes them a letter encouraging them, and then he authors the tshuva about, and this is what everything broke down over this to a certain extent, of women rabbis. So we'll get to all this. Od chazon l'moed. Someone privately emails me that Rabbi Shubah's brother was the judge. No, Rabbi Shubah's brother was not the judge. The judge was someone, he was Jewish, but he was someone else. So I don't know Rabbi Kelman who this Grammy is. So, there's someone they give to the
Grammy's big award. I think it's an American award. Maybe it's a Canadian award. I don't even know. But they say that he won the award because of the choir in Shar Shemaim, which was his shul. That was his family shul.
Okay. Judge Abraham.
Okay, somebody pointed out ancestors, Bill Goritz was pointing out his ancestors were the presidents of the shul. Yeah, he was a member of the shul. Leonard Cohen was a member of Shar Shemaim.
Oh, yes, Leonard Cohen, exactly. And finally, the last comment, Rabbi Feldman's father said in shuls on Friday evening, say Abdullah right after Kiddush. Listen, we know that there was, I'll leave it to the people to fight. I don't need to get involved with those disputes. But I thank you all, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. Okay, we look forward to next week, always leaving us with more information to come. And we look forward to next week and in between to learning with you during the week. Like I mentioned at the beginning, tomorrow morning, Rachel Dan Sharansky Danziger begins her series on relationships in the book of Bereshit. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. And Thursday, Shuli Mishkin begins her series. All we have the Parsha Shir this week will be given by Rabbi Nachbar from Tinak. David Nachbar teaches at GPATS and at TABC. And I'll be giving, of course, I started last week, a closer look at the Siddur on Friday morning. Sunday, Rabbi Lieptag begins his new series on number 7 and creation. And that'll be Sunday. And then, well, continuing with a few more classes, I will let people know it's not on the website yet because we just sort of did it from Yosef Carmel from the Rosh Kol of Eretz Chemda. I don't know if people know him. He's really he's a major person in Israel and a really clear, articulate speaker. We'll be giving a series, probably a 6-part series, Ifrit. We're going to do an Ifrit before we've had individual classes in Hebrew, but this will be the first time we're going to do a whole series in Ifrit. So hopefully, people will come, will be interested. We'll let you know. We haven't finalized the date yet, but, just to let you know in advance, we have a couple more classes. So, always want to hear, like I say, always want to hear ideas and suggestions and, any critique and ways for improvement. Always want to hear and, do invite your friends and we look forward to learning with you and everybody have a wonderful night and a wonderful week and, all good things. And we look forward to seeing you in the near future. Laila Tov, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.